Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Let's go back into the Jeff Sessions confirmation hearing. Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump's nominee for Attorney General. Let's listen to maybe just a few more seconds of his confirmation opening statement live.
The denial of voting rights has had on our African-American brothers and sisters. I have witnessed it. We must continue to move forward and never back. I understand the demands for justice and fairness made by our LGBT community. I will ensure that the statutes protecting their civil rights and their safety are fully enforced. I understand the lifelong scars borne by women who are victims of assault and abuse. And if I am so fortunate to be confirmed as your Attorney General, you can know that I understand the absolute necessity that all my actions must fall within the bounds of the Constitution and the laws of the United States. While all humans must recognize the limits of their abilities, and I certainly do, I am ready for this job.
Jeff Sessions in his opening statement. My next guest is Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate. We'll preview President Obama's farewell address, which is scheduled for tonight at 9 o'clock, and we'll carry it live here on WNYC with Jamelle. But Jamelle, hi. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And I want to get your reaction to what we just heard, if you could hear it, of Jeff Sessions kind of invoking that he gets it about racism and rights. He gets it about women and rights. He gets it about LGBT and rights. And then his very next statement was, I respect the limits that the Constitution imposes on us. And I couldn't tell whether that was to back up his stated respect for those rights or whether to say, but hey, people, we're not going to go beyond the Constitution to establish special rights.
You know, you can color me skeptical of Senator Sessions' commitment to civil rights. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund put out a very comprehensive look at Sessions' career, not just as a senator, but as a prosecutor in the Department of Justice in the 1980s and as Attorney General for the state of Alabama in the 1990s. And sort of the signature line from this analysis of Sessions' career is an unrelenting hostility towards civil rights and racial justice has been the defining feature of Jeff Sessions' professional life. And so from the beginning, he is wrongfully prosecuting black civil rights workers in the state. He was part of a lawsuit against the Department of Justice and its Alabama division for selective prosecutions of black civil rights activists or black election workers, rather than white ones who were committing or doing similar actions. Upon becoming state attorney general, he immediately moved to relitigate a school desegregation case, trying to argue that the burden was too great on the school district. I mean, you kind of just go down the list here and collect example after example of Jeff Sessions throughout his professional life opposing or slowing or standing in the way of efforts to ameliorate the effects of racism and discrimination. And so for Sessions now, when he has a job on the line to kind of evince this commitment, I think we should take that with a very large grain of salt.
We'll hear more of the Jeff Sessions confirmation hearing as the show goes along. I want to turn the page with Jamelle Bouie now because the occasion of President Obama's farewell address tonight has led Jamelle to revisit another speech on Slate, a sermon really that's associated with Obama as a vehicle for taking stock of the president's strengths and weaknesses, as Jamelle does as President Obama leaves office. And of all things, it's the sermon once given by Obama's former pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who Obama basically had to denounce to get elected. The sermon famous for lines like this.
No, no, no. Not God bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible.
And so, Jamel, I thought your article was a great one for a radio show to make your point in sound. So I have the next 2 minutes from your edit of that Jeremiah Wright sermon queued up and ready to play. After you set up for everybody why you chose to revisit that particular controversy at this particular time. Will you do that?
Sure. And so, you know, at this particular time, we're, less than 2 weeks at this point from Donald Trump being elected or being inaugurated President of the United States. And Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, ran a campaign that at the very least exploited deep racial division, nativist feeling, racial anxiety, so on and so forth. And sort of that, those feelings, those things that Donald Trump relied on during his campaign have been sort of either, you know, underneath the surface of Obama's presidency or at certain points kind of just flared up entirely in the past 8 years, have witnessed, I think, a kind of backlash to the race, symbolic racial progress that Barack Obama represents. That backlash isn't to clarify, that isn't commiserate with the partisan backlash, but it's sort of separate, although it informs some elements of that latter backlash. And so, you know, Obama's giving his farewell address. He'll likely speak in these optimistic and broad terms, but I'm not sure those optimistic terms are really equipped to deal with the reality of the kind of racial animosity that's surfaced in the last year and a half or so.
And so let me just tell everybody that your article is called The Obama Paradox. You're framing a paradox, right?
Right. And so the paradox is that the kind of clear-eyed or less forgiving view of the United States that would that includes space for imagining the kind of backlash, the kind of racial backlash Obama faced, is one that's sort of rooted in a sense of historical guilt attached to America. America did these things, and those things have concrete and material consequences down the line. And Obama, as a political figure, kind of had to repudiate that whole notion that Americans have any sort of guilt tied to their past. And he did that in kind of most vivid form after the Jeremiah Wright controversy with the speech we now call the More Perfect Union speech. And so I thought now, you know, given what's about to come, was a good time not just to revisit A More Perfect Union, but to revisit that Jeremiah Wright speech and to, I think, show how Wright's language notwithstanding, that sermon contained a very astute message about America and its relationship to its history and to its past. And in a way, Wright was right about the country and Obama was quite wrong. And Obama's wrongness isn't the right word, but I'm going to go with it, is evident in the fact that I don't think he's really come up with a strong response to the fact of Donald Trump.
But the stretch of Jeremiah Wright that you seem to really want us to hear, you included the video in your Slate article, is not a framing of hopelessly, permanently racist America, but one that also embraced hope and change and that says governments can change and our government has changed in this respect over the history of the country. So let me play just a little bit of that stretch that you pulled for your article.
Prior to Abraham Lincoln, the government in this country said it was legal to hold Africans in slavery in perpetuity. Perpetuity is one of the University of Chicago words. That means forever. From now on. When Lincoln got in office, the government changed. Prior to the passing of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, the government defined Africans as slaves, as property. Property. People with no rights to be respected by any whites anywhere. The Supreme Court of the government, same court, granddaddy court of the one that stole the 2000 election, Supreme Court said in its Dred Scott decision in the 1850s, no African anywhere in this country has any rights that any white person has to respect at any place, anytime. That was the government's official position, backed up by the Supreme Court, that's the judiciary, backed up by the executive branch, branch, that's the president, backed up by the legislative branch and enforced by the military of the government. But I stopped by to tell you tonight that governments change. Prior to Harry Truman's government, the military in this country was segregated. But governments changed prior to the civil rights and equal accommodations laws of the government in this country. There was back segregation by the country, legal discrimination by the government, prohibited blacks from voting by the government. You had to eat in separate places by the government. You had to sit in different places from white folk because the government says so. And you had to be buried in a separate cemetery. It was apartheid American style from the cradle to the grave, all because the government backed it up. But guess what? Governments changed. Under Bill Clinton, we got a messed up welfare to work bill. But under Clinton, blacks had an intelligent friend in the Oval Office.
Jeremiah Wright, and who thought we would be revisiting a two-minute excerpt of that speech today? But Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate, brings it up in the context of his article previewing the end of the Obama administration. I don't know how different things would have been if a lot of people had played that clip in 2008, but that wasn't just goddamn America. That was hope and change. Our government changed under Lincoln. Our government changed under Truman. Our government changed for better in racial terms under Bill Clinton.
Right. And so I think where the contrast, where you see the contrast is that that's – if this were Obama, that's kind of where the story would end. But Wright sort of from there moves on essentially to say that, you know, well, governments, they lie about the truth. They can change from those lies, but they can also fail and kind of return – in a way to a place they were in the past. And so the section of the sermon that sets up Goddamn America is detailing the ways in which the country still fails black Americans and other people of color. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important to grasp that time does not move on some linear march towards progress. And while Obama, I don't think, would agree necessarily with that, I don't think he's that – I don't think his view of things is that Pollyanna-ish. He certainly does seem to agree with the oft-quoted statement that the arc of the universe bends towards justice. And I think what Wright suggests in his sort of government lies, government changes, government fails dynamic is that maybe that bending takes a very long time. Maybe it bends back in really profound ways, bends back away from justice. But the second thing is, it's still the case, even if the universe is bending towards justice, that there are people who will live entire lives under injustice. And the 30,000-foot teleological view here, the looking towards the future view, can obscure the fact that, as I wrote in the piece, that if you are an enslaved person in the 1830s, you'll likely die an enslaved person. And the fact that your descendants may no longer be enslaved does not change the fact of your existence. And I think that's a really important thing to understand and to realize. And I think Wright kind of presents that. But kind of the meta point, I mean, it's sort of a bit of a narrower point. But the meta point here is that if your vision of American history includes the real possibility of regress, of long-term regress, then I think it's easier to conceptualize something like an intense racial backlash. You can kind of fit that into your mental schema.
Right.
Or the
election of Donald Trump after 8 years of Barack Obama, or in the context of when he gave that speech after 2000. And we're going to play one more little clip of it to make your point. People with long enough memories, you know, and I was around, I remember how much hope for change there was when Bill Clinton was elected after 12 years of Reagan and Bush, among people who found that such a relief. So then you had 8 years of Bill Clinton, then you had the Bush versus Gore election. And obviously George W. Bush was elected. And so Jeremiah Wright gave the sermon that included that two-minute section that we played about how governments do change and can change in this country. And there is hope because Lincoln did something and Truman did something and Clinton did something. But then he went on to say this.
Oh, but government's changed. The election was stolen. We went from an intelligent friend to a dumb Dixiecrat, a rich Republican who has never held a job in his life, is against affirmative action, against education, I guess he is, against health care, against benefits for his own military, and gives tax breaks to the wealthiest contributors to his campaign.
And he goes on from there. But I guess you pulled that, Jamel, for your piece because it makes the point of progress not being a straight line. And after he went through that whole exposition about how governments can change for the better, there was that moment after 2000, whether you feel the election was literally stolen by the Supreme Court or not, that, uh-oh, we're in a moment of retrenchment.
Right, right. And again, not just retrenchment. I think the thing to pull away from Wright's sermon, and particularly the part kind of just immediately before the Goddamn America section, is that the regress can be very deep and abiding, and that it can be so deep and abiding that we must, you know, remain, I think politically, if you're kind of draw a political lesson from it, you must remain vigilant of that fact. And I'm not sure Obama was as vigilant of that fact as he ought to have been during his 8 years for understandable reasons. Again, this gets to the paradox of it all, that the kind of vision of the United States that Wright is articulating, if you have that as a black politician, you probably are not going to get elected president of the United States or get reelected president of the United States. The bounds of acceptable the bounds of acceptable thought for black politicians are narrower. And so, you know, Obama was very emphatic about his belief in the basic goodness and decency of the country. Donald Trump's slogan was "Make America Great Again," right? That the country is trash, and if you elect me, I'll make it better. And that's a bit of a luxury, I think, you get message-wise if you do not belong to a minority group.
Jamel Bowie with us, chief political correspondent for Slate. You know, there is pushback on this kind of racial analysis that would say Hillary Clinton lost because white people in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan, in counties that Obama won, voted in larger numbers for Trump. That argument would say this wasn't a white lash, as Van Jones put it. Maybe it was a man lash or something else. But Obama was elected twice, and Hillary Clinton didn't carry enough of his counties. How does that look to you?
I find that analysis to be really unconvincing because it sort of relies on a vision of racism in which simply voting for a black politician in the same way that maybe having a black friend is to sort of get out of jail free card indefinitely. That you can, if you've done that, then no one could credibly describe your motivations as racial. Although I will emphasize, as I have many times before, that I have no idea what the motivations of Trump voters are, but it is without a doubt that Trump's campaign was soaked in racial resentment. And so at the very least, Trump supporters were able to look past that. And so that's, I think, where I would go with this, that the fact that they voted for Barack Obama, and it should be said Barack Obama was an exceptional politician, perhaps one of the best of his generation, who ran an almost flawless campaign. And so they voted for – and in 2008, we were in the middle of a financial crisis. So they voted for Obama under those circumstances. And then when presented with a less than exceptional candidate – who was openly disparaging of racial minorities, some number of them voted for him as well. I think at the very least, we should think about what it means that those voters look past that candidate's racial views. I think the fact that in order to win their votes, Obama had to be absolutely exceptional is in fact an indictment of them, that their standards for voting for someone that person is non-white seem to be much higher. If they're a woman, seem to be much higher than their standards for voting for a man. And so I don't see how that really like complicates anything. I mean, it just doesn't. There are plenty of examples in American history where people, white Americans, have made strategic alliances with people of color for the sake of advancing a particular political perspective or particular political interest. And then once that interest has been reached, they kind of go back to, a more racialized politics. And that seems to be the dynamic here. That doesn't mean that Hillary Clinton did not run a flawed campaign. It doesn't mean that she wasn't a flawed candidate. Both of those things are very true. But the attempt to use that to erase the fact that we all witnessed, the thing we all saw, which was a candidate who ran an explicitly racialized campaign focused on demonizing Hispanic immigrants and Muslim Americans, won the presidency based off an almost exclusively white electoral coalition. If you're telling me that this is not a racial thing, then I'm going to tell you that American history strongly disagrees with you.
So before you go, you and Slate in general are very much about not normalizing Donald Trump right now. And your critique of Obama even extends to this context. You write, you can feel the inadequacy in how Obama has approached the transition to Trump, treating him as a normal political figure, unquote. So would you like President Obama to show less respect in some way for the will of the voters, if you want to call it that, and the respectful transition of power?
I guess I would like Obama to be more openly hard-nosed about Trump, about not necessarily extending him the benefit of the doubt, of respecting the office, but recognizing that Trump's conduct, to hold to the rhetoric used to the campaign. Throughout the campaign, Obama said that Trump was not fit for the Oval Office, and I understand, but I don't see why he cannot continue that language approaching the end of his administration.
So last question, what do you expect and what do you hope to hear that you would judge as adequate in President Obama's farewell address tonight?
I'm not that great at sort of predicting what I'll hear from a presidential speech. So my view on that is that, we'll see what he says. What I hope he would say, however, is not just to give a message of optimism, which he clearly plans, but to be forthright about the dangers we face and to be honest about the fact that we are actually on the precipice of moving away from our democratic traditions, of undermining our democratic norms, of seeing a fall into a kind of authoritarianism under an administration that, as we can see just from its conduct with regards to confirming cabinet members, has this blatant disregard for established precedent and norms and law. That's serious, and I would hope Obama does not diminish the seriousness of that.
Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.